From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Francis Ford Coppola's Vietnam epic Apocalypse Now is back in theaters in a new recut expanded version. On today's Fresh Air, stories about the making of the film. It was plagued by production delays and stuck in a Vietnam-like quagmire. We hear from Eleanor Coppola, Francis's wife, who kept a journal while on location, and from sound designer Walter Murch and actors Robert Duvall, Martin Sheen, and Larry Fishburne. And we welcome back film critic John Powers, who reviews the new recut film. Apocalypse Now and Then, coming up on Fresh Air.
This is the end, beautiful friend. This is the end, my only friend.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the most anticipated films of the summer isn't a new movie. It's a recut version of Francis Ford Coppola's Vietnam epic Apocalypse Now. The new version was edited from scratch from the original raw footage and includes 49 minutes of previously unseen footage. Apocalypse Now Redux opens today in New York and Los Angeles and will open in 30 more cities over the next 2 weeks. We're going to hear some behind-the-scenes stories from actors and others who are on the set. First, we have a review from film critic John Powers, who is returning to Fresh Air after a year abroad.
When Apocalypse Now came out in 1979, it was nearly impossible to see it clean. For this was the first great movie to be defined, even overwhelmed, by its production history. Although director Francis Coppola's previous films, The Godfather, Godfather II, and The Conversation, made him the best American filmmaker of his era, the media didn't give him a break. All you heard was how he was throwing away money, how things were going nuts over there in the Philippines, how everyone was swimming in sex and drugs, which in fact was true. While the public liked the film's surreal grandeur, the official guardians of culture greeted it less as a movie than as an occasion for moralizing about hubris and folly and excess. Apocalypse Now lost the 1980 Best Picture Oscar to Kramer vs. Kramer, a movie that nobody's thought about since. But many people have continued to think about Apocalypse Now, including Coppola, who's put together a much longer new version of the film with scenes that have never before been shown. This Redux version lets us grasp, for the first time, the full richness and complexity of the original conception. The story remains the same, a Vietnam War reworking of Conrad's Heart of Darkness. The pre-presidential Martin Sheen plays Captain Benjamin Willard, who sent to terminate with extreme prejudice Marlon Brando's character, the run-amok Colonel Kurtz. Willard heads upriver in a boat with four men, including a chef played by Frederick Forrest and a kid played by the gangly young Lawrence Fishburne. Along the way, they meet Robert Duvall's swaggering Kilgore, the Wagner-playing air cowboy who loves the smell of napalm in the morning. They see a phantasmic USO show with Playboy bunnies. They witness massacres, and they themselves slaughter an innocent Vietnamese family. By the time Willard finally reaches Kurtz in Cambodia, he's traveled so far beyond his familiar ideas of good and evil that he doesn't know whether or not he should carry out his mission. Kurtz senses this confusion in one of their early encounters.
Are my methods unsound? I don't see any method. At all. I expected someone like you. What did you expect? Are you an assassin? Soldier. You're neither. You're an errand boy sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
While Apocalypse Now Redux is being talked about for its new scenes, what strikes you first is just how visually ravishing the new print is. Made with a dye transfer process resembling Technicolor, the images are lusher than ever before, with stunning reds and greens and a blackness that takes on a velvety depth. The director of photography, Dittorio Storaro, said that the new print's richness made him want to cry. And watching, you'll understand why. This is one of the best shot movies ever made. You feel the terrible beauty of napalm forests and flares shrieking into the night sky. And now the story itself feels fuller. The original always seemed choppy, as if Willard's boat was simply racing from one bravura set piece to the next. Here, the journey upriver has breathing space for nifty bits of character, like Willard stealing Kilgore's surfboard. And in a wholly new sequence of nearly 20 minutes, we enter a colonial rubber plantation whose French owners are determined to fight to the death rather than give in to the Vietnamese. You can see why the scene was originally left out. There's some painfully over-explanatory dialogue. But you can also see how it deepens the story. it puts America's adventure in Vietnam into historical perspective. And in Willard's brief erotic encounter with a ghostly French widow, the movie offers a counterweight to all the killing. There's a feminine world of sensuality and love that men like Willard and Kurtz have left far, far behind. Back in 1979, Willard's showdown with Kurtz was actually a letdown, not least because it was our first encounter with the fat Brando. People gasped when they saw him. All these years later, after he's grown ever bigger, his obesity's no longer a surprise. In fact, we're now struck that he looks kind of thin. And his performance is pretty good, especially considering that he's been forced to read T.S. Eliot's The Hollow Men. The ending is still the movie's weakest link, but 20 years on, its metaphysical guff doesn't matter very much. It now seems incredible that critics could have ever become fixated on that, instead of noticing the audacity and ambition of the spectacular journey upriver, a sustained piece of brilliance that hasn't been surpassed or even attempted by an American movie since. Coppola made Apocalypse Now when the Vietnam War was still fresh in people's minds. Yet he wasn't afraid to tackle its wildest excesses and its darkest horrors. This is a movie whose heroes commit atrocities. Now it's the filmmakers who commit them. When Hollywood goes to Cambodia these days, it's in order to make Tomb Raider. When it tells us to remember Pearl Harbor, it wants us to forget what actually happened there. The film world is now run by errand boys, sent by grocery clerks to collect a bill.
Film critic John Powers is the executive editor of LA Weekly. He's returned to Fresh Air after a year abroad. Henry Sheehan, who was our film critic this past year, will now be reviewing new DVDs and videos. The makers of Apocalypse Now were said to have run into some of the same problems that faced the men who fought the war. Once they got in, they got deeper and deeper and couldn't pull themselves out. The 1992 documentary called Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, showed how director Francis Coppola dealt with recreating jungle warfare in the Philippines during a real civil war. There were times Coppola was sure he could not make a movie out of his increasingly incoherent footage.
What I have to admit is that I don't know what I'm doing.
Well, how do you account for the discrepancy between what you feel about it and what everybody else who sees it?
Because they see the magic of what has happened before. I'm saying, hey, it's not going to happen. I don't have any performances. The script doesn't make sense. I have no ending. I'm like a voice crying out, saying, please, it's not working. Somebody get me off this. And nobody listens to me. Everyone says, yes, well, Francis works best in a crisis. I'm saying this is one crisis I'm not going to pull myself out of. I'm making a bad movie, so why should I go ahead? I'm going to be bankrupt anyway. Why can't I just have the courage to say it's no good?
The documentary footage shot during the making of Apocalypse Now was directed by Eleanor Coppola, Francis's wife, at his request. She's also the author of Notes on the Making of Apocalypse Now, a book version of her journals. I spoke with her in 1992. When Marlon Brando arrived on the set to play Kurtz, Francis Coppola didn't realize that Brando was going to be as heavy as he was. How did that affect the way the role was conceived?
Well, when Francis realized that he was not slimmed down and able to play the Green Beret that he was originally committed to the part for, that Francis had to decide what to do in the situation, and his first idea was to play Marlon as an indulging, mango-eating, over-indulging himself here in the jungle in this situation, and just play him sort of overweight and his uniform not really fitting properly, and just go with that whole kind of look. And Marlon did not want to do that. He just was unwilling to do that. So then Francis was really at a loss. What could he do then if he wouldn't do that? So the two of them sat down for days talking about what part he could play and how they could resolve the ending of this movie. And they at one point came up with this very theatrical, larger-than-life personage that's, you see, just emerging from the darkness and the light, and you never really fully see him as a reality. He's much more of a sort of an archetypical, you know, mythical figure. And that was sort of a new approach for Brando, because he was known for his great, you know, reality, the grittiness of his realness in his performances, so that he struggled with that too. And the two of them had a real head-to-head go there, trying to resolve the ending of the film.
A lot of Marlon Brando's part was improvised. There's some really interesting footage in Hearts of Darkness of Brando improvising. Would you describe a little bit the process that he and Francis Coppola used to improvise the part?
Well, they would come up with some actual lines and some of the dialogue that Marlon was to say, but the way Marlon works is he has to find a reality, so he would then put those lines into kind of a sort of free form improvising and talking as he went along through the part. So they had definite points that he was supposed to make, and he then kind of created around those points and kind of gives it that reality. Because one of the things he does, he, for instance, will like write a line on his hand or put it on a piece of tape on one of the props nearby, so that he sort of has to look for that line and sort of give it that little edge of struggle, that just like we have in our own conversation, I don't know exactly what line I'm going to say next, and it gives my, you know, voice a kind of edgy reality, because I'm sort of fishing for what the next line is going to be. And he does that. It's part of his technique to not learn his lines and just spit them out slickly, but to really just have to have that little edge of reaching for them.
It sounds from the footage you shot that one of the techniques that they'd use to improvise is that Francis Coppola would ask Marlon Brando questions off camera, and then Brando would have to respond to the questions, and the camera would be rolling as he responded.
Yes, that's right.
Why are we in Vietnam?
It's our time to grab this moment in history. It's our time to teach. Huh? I can't think of any more dialogue today.
We're listening to a 1992 interview with Eleanor Coppola, who kept a journal and produced documentary footage about the making of Apocalypse Now. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Apocalypse Now Redux began opening in theaters today. Before we hear more from Eleanor Coppola, let's hear another scene from the film. Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen, has just arrived at the compound of the renegade Colonel Kurtz. He meets a photojournalist at the compound, played by Dennis Hopper.
Who are all these people?
Yeah, well, they think you've come to take him away, and I hope that isn't true.
Take who away?
Him, Colonel Kurtz. These are all his children, man, as far as you can see. Hell, man, out here, we're all his children.
Could we talk to Colonel Kurtz?
Hey, man, you don't talk to the Colonel. Well, you listen to him. The man's enlarged my mind. He's a poet, warrior in the classic sense. I mean, sometimes you'll say hello to him, right? And he'll just walk right by you, and he won't even notice you. And then suddenly he'll grab you, and he'll throw you in a corner, and he'll say, "Do you know that if is the middle word in life? If you can keep your head when all about you are losing theirs and blaming it on you, if you can trust yourself when all men doubt you." I mean, I can't. I'm a little man. He's a great man. I should have been a pair of ragged claws scuttling across floors of silent seas. I mean,
stay with the boat.
Hey, don't go without me, okay? I want to get a picture.
Dennis Hopper played the part of a really drugged-out American journalist in Vietnam. When he was cast in this role, he already had the reputation for being genuinely drugged out and burned out. And there's some terrific footage in the documentary of him and Francis Coppola talking together and trying to, like, work out what the part's going to be. And Coppola wants to know how come he doesn't know his lines yet. Why did Coppola even bring on Dennis Hopper? And I'm a really big fan of Hopper's asking this question, but he was in such bad shape then. You know, you wonder, why would you ask for this kind of trouble?
Well, I don't think Francis actually realized he was in that kind of shape. He thought he was a really good actor, and he had a lot of admiration for him, and he was cast in a role, a Green Beret role, and when he really got out there, Francis realized there's no way that he could play this the Green Beret, and he had to then sort of invent a part for him because he thought he was very talented and there must be some way to use his gifts. And so Francis has the great ability to make the part fit the actor rather than the other way around. If the actor comes and can't play the part as written, he rewrites the part. And he certainly did that in Dennis's case, and tried to somehow utilize the character that he was, because that was one of the issues in the Vietnam War, is the use of drugs and the availability of drugs. And in fact, there in the Philippines, because of where we were there in Asia, there were drugs available and cheaply, and things that aren't available just here in while everybody's home in Los Angeles, so that there was experimentation among the people who were out there. And Dennis, of course, was just really far out at that moment. In fact, he looks back at that period and is pretty astounded himself, I think.
Why did you say that to him in the scene?
Who?
Something clever like that. When
you
he says,
why?
Who are you?
You know
why did you say, who are you?
Because I haven't learned my lines yet.
I know, you've
why.
Had him for 5 days.
The other thing I'd like to say is that...
These glasses,
I can't see anything through them. But, like, you know, every crack represents a life I've saved. You know what I mean? They represent a life I've saved.
You say that all out in the scene.
I do, but you see, the director, you know, the director says, you don't know your lines. And then, like,
well,
you know,
if you know your lines, then you can forget them.
Oh,
you know more or less.
I see. But that's what I'm trying to do. Forget those lines.
No, but it's no fair to forget them if you never knew them.
One of the stories that the movie gets into, the documentary on the making of Apocalypse Now, is how Francis Coppola used helicopters from the Philippine Army because the United States Army wouldn't cooperate with the making of a movie about Vietnam. But the government kept wanting the helicopters back to fight a civil war against communist insurgents. Tell us some of the ways that kept disrupting the shooting of Apocalypse Now.
It was a very disruptive situation because the Army would send out their helicopters and whatever pilots they wanted to send out, and the pilots would be different every day, so they hadn't rehearsed. They didn't realize what it was like to fly in through filming situations, and they would sometimes they'd fly too high and they wouldn't be in the camera shot, or they just wouldn't realize what was involved in really performing for the camera, so to speak. So they would lose many shots because the pilots wouldn't be flying in the right place to be seen in the camera. And then the next day, you know, by the time they finally learned how to do it, the next day they'd send different pilots. And then very frequently they would call the planes away. They'd be all set up for a shot. Everyone would be out there on the location shooting, and they would get some radio communication that that four of the helicopters had to leave for, you know, military reasons, or some days all of the helicopters, or some days they would be out there ready to work and expecting 8 helicopters to be provided, and only 2 would show up. So it was a very difficult part of the production, and it cost, you know, tens and tens of thousands of dollars in lost footage and waiting for the helicopters to come that never came.
During the making of Apocalypse Now, you sent your husband a telex telling him he was becoming like Kurtz and creating his own Vietnam with his supply of wines and steaks and air conditioners. And you send copies of this telex to the set designer, the cinematographer, and the production manager. Why did you do that? I mean, something had must have really been working on you for you to not only telex Francis, but to telex the people who he worked with.
Well, at that moment, in my opinion, I was really concerned that you know, the whole thing was going too far and had the potential of tipping over the edge. And that was just my response to the situation at that point in time. And I mean, now we're looking back at it, and so it doesn't seem so appropriate. But in the intensity of the moment, that was the moment where I just felt I had to speak out and give my opinion. And all throughout this project, it kept going, you know, closer and closer and closer to the edge, it seemed like. And in fact, I felt the forces and the pressure on Francis were so profound that I was very worried that he wouldn't be able to withstand all of those pressures. That was my one, you know, really deep and major concern, is that somehow it would just push him over the edge in some way. And in fact, he did collapse at one point and faint. And there was a moment where I was concerned, you know, that he might have a nervous breakdown or something. But he is a strong person, and he, after a couple of days, he was able to get his strength back and get his balance back and go on with the project and complete it. But there were some very scary moments there.
Eleanor Coppola, recorded in 1992. We'll hear more on the making of Apocalypse Now in the second half of the show. The expanded, re-edited version, Apocalypse Now Redux, opened today in New York and Los Angeles and opens in 30 more cities over the next couple of weeks. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the making of Apocalypse Now. We hear from sound designer Walter Murch and actors Martin Sheen, Larry Fishburne, and Robert Duvall. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The recut, expanded version of Francis Ford Coppola's Vietnam epic Apocalypse Now is opening in theaters. Apocalypse Now Redux was edited by Walter Murch. He was the sound designer on the original version and won an Academy Award for his work. He was also the sound designer on The Godfather and won a double Oscar for film editing and sound mixing on The English Patient. When I spoke with Murch in 1996, he brought in the audio track from his scene in Apocalypse Now.
This is at the beginning of the film, and the Willard character, who's played by Martin Sheen, is cooped up in a hotel room in Saigon. He's found that there's no place in the world for him other than Vietnam. He's tried to go home. He can't. And yet he's stuck in this hotel room, and they won't give him a mission. They won't let him go out into the jungle. So it's a scene of a man stewing in his own juices. What we're looking at is this images of a man trying to pass the time in a hotel room. What you're going to hear is a transition from the street sounds of Saigon to the sounds of the jungle, so that visually there's a discontinuity they don't quite add up. You're looking at a man in a hotel room, but you're hearing jungle sounds. And so there's a fruitful discontinuity there that allows you to get inside the character's head.
Let's hear it.
Saigon. I'm still only in Saigon. Every time I think I'm going to wake up back in the jungle, when I was home after my first tour, it was worse. I'd wake up and there'd be nothing. I hardly said a word to my wife until I said yes to a divorce. Here, I wanted to be there. When I was there, all I could think of was getting back into the jungle. I'm here a week now, waiting for a mission, getting softer. Every minute I stay in this room, I get weaker. And every minute Charlie squats in the bush, he gets stronger. Each time I looked around, the walls moved in a little tighter.
Very nice. Now, did you record Martin Sheen's voice also?
Yes, yeah.
What were you looking for? There's a kind of a very interior monologue sound to the way his voice is recorded. I think you probably recorded that differently than if he was actually having a conversation with somebody.
Yeah, no, the microphone was, we moved it as close as physically possible to him and then asked him to almost whisper.
Mm-hmm.
So that it gives an interior quality to it that conventional narration, which has a sort of a documentary film feel, would not have. We wanted at all costs to avoid that and to give you some way to get inside the head of this character.
Another scene from Apocalypse Now that you did the sound from that you've brought with you. This is a battle scene. Describe what's happening in this.
This is midway in the film, and Willard, again the Martin Sheen character, is trapped in some trenches. There's a sniper out in the darkness that nobody can seem to kill. And he runs across a group of people, one of whom is a human bat who has great echolocation. And the scene involves getting this person, who likes to sleep a lot because he's of his bat-like nature, to come out and, by echolocation, by listening to this sniper's voice, to kill him with a grenade launcher. Visually, what you're seeing is a full battle. Flashes are going off. It takes place at night. It's very dramatic. But listen to what's happening, and you can hear gradually all of the sound goes away except for the single voice of this sniper who's taunting the GIs in a mixture of Vietnamese and English.
Who's the commanding officer here?
Ain't you? Run these bodies, man!
Get the roach! We're gonna go get the roach. Go get them. Roach! 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 You got slopes on the wire, man. You hear him? Roach! Do you hear him? We're busting. him out there on the wire, man.
Yeah.
You need a flare?
No. He's close, man. He's real close.
Hey, soldier.
Well, Walter Murch, I bet you listen that way, too. I bet you get so focused on some things you're listening to that everything else kind of falls away.
Well, we all do. I mean, it's the cocktail party effect, you know, where you're able to focus in on somebody's conversation in the middle of a very big party. And even though 50 other people may be yakking away, you can hear what that one person's saying. It's part of everyone's constitution. It's just when you work in sound, you tend to do more of that because it has to do with how you are going to put the film together.
How much footage did you have to edit in Apocalypse Now? Can you give us a sense of how many feet or how many hours worth? How about how many hours worth? That would probably be more meaningful.
Well, the film is just under 2.5 hours long, and there were just under 250 hours of material.
Wow.
So it's roughly 100 hours of material for every hour that made it on the screen. So it's actually amazing that we finished it as quickly as we did.
So why was there so much footage?
Partly the technique by which they filmed the battles. They would load up cameras of with a 10-minute load of film and have 8 cameras positioned simultaneously and then simply let loose this gigantic complex machinery of a battle. And it was actually like a battle was taking place in front of your eyes. If you happened to be standing there, you would be less aware of cameras than of there's a battle going on. So it was documentary in a sense. And any documentary has a very large shooting ratio. So there was a high documentary component to Apocalypse Now, where fortuitous things would happen and you would capture those things. But in order to increase your chances of getting something fortuitous, you had to generate a lot of footage to do that.
Could you see the difference between takes? I mean, was it always clear to you which take was the best take?
Well, it's a funny question because what is good in one context is not good in another. And that's, if there's a mystery to film editing, it's probably that. You probably put your finger right on it. Things that you look at, that part of you says, oh, that's not very good. Another part of you says, but you know, in this context, it actually might be great. There's a scene where they're briefing Willard on his mission. And the Harrison Ford character, the trick of that scene was that Francis told the operator operator of the camera to go wherever he wanted, not to be swayed by whatever anyone was saying. So none of the actors knew when the camera was going to be on them or off them. And there's one scene where Harrison Ford, as an actor, is looking at the camera trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? But the stare that he gives the camera, and he's looking right into the camera at that point, has an unnerving, actually a wonderful effect, which is it reads as a look to Martin Sheen, a look to Willard that says, we're in a very deep situation here, and I have to play this game by the rules, but I hope you have a lot of luck out there, soldier. So you read a tremendous amount into that look, although the look itself was simply Harrison Ford as an actor trying to figure out, is the camera on me or not? So, you know, it's one of the rules of film editing of never have the actors look into the camera. Here, that rule is violated, so it's technically a mistake, but within the context of the scene, which is one of a building up paranoia, it actually fits very well.
Walter Murch, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Well, you too. Thank you very much, Terry.
Walter Murch recorded in 1996. He won an Oscar for his work as the sound designer on Apocalypse Now. He edited the new version of the film, Apocalypse Now Redux. Here's the scene Murch was just describing.
Every man has got a breaking point. You and I have them. Walt Kurtz has reached his. And very obviously, he has gone insane.
Yes, sir. Very much so, sir. Obviously insane.
Your mission is to proceed up the Nung River in a Navy patrol boat. Pick up Colonel Kurtz's path at Nu Mung Ba. Follow it, learn what you can along the way. When you find the Colonel, infiltrate his team by whatever means available and terminate the Colonel's command.
Terminate the Colonel.
He's out there operating without any decent restraint, totally beyond the pale of any acceptable human conduct. And he's still in the field commanding troops.
Terminate with extreme prejudice.
Coming up, some of the stars of Apocalypse Now share their memories. This is Fresh Air. The expanded, recut version of Apocalypse Now has begun to open in theaters. We're going to hear from some of the actors. The central character is Captain Willard, played by Martin Sheen, who now stars as President Bartlett on the West Wing. At the beginning of Apocalypse Now, Sheen is cooped up in a hotel room in Saigon, waiting to be told what his mission is. The heat, claustrophobia, and anxiety are getting to him. He gets drunk and smashes his fist through the hotel room mirror and smears the blood across his body. That opening scene was shot 25 years ago today. I talked about it with Sheen in 1991.
Can you tell us a little bit about the shooting of the opening scene?
The absolute truth about it was shot on my 36th birthday, August the 3rd, 1976, in a little town called Santa Cruz in the local city hall, which we were using as a hotel. And I had been drinking all of that day, and I was quite inebriated by the time we got to filming that scene. And I asked Francis to allow me to wrestle, in a sense, with some demons that were inside of me that I was wrestling with for a number of years. And I thought this would be an opportunity, in a sense, to get them out in the open, to wrestle with them in public, to wrestle with them on film. And he was very reluctant, and particularly when I hurt myself in the middle of the scene, he tried to stop it. I slammed my hand into a mirror, which I didn't even know was there.
This is when you're practicing karate chops, right?
He tried to stop a scene. I said, no, please continue on. And he had two cameras going, and I begged him not to stop.
And you're referring to the part where you're kind of like practicing moves and karate chops, and you accidentally put your hand through the mirror.
Inebriated, I could hardly stand up, you know, and I was very vulnerable, and a lot of my pain came to the surface. There was no defense left, and you saw, really, in a sense, who I was at that time. I was a very confused man, very unhappy man, and I came to grips with it there.
Martin Sheen recorded in 1991. Larry Fishburne was just a teenager, the son of a corrections officer, when he co-starred in Apocalypse Now as the young soldier in the boat with Martin Sheen going upriver into Cambodia on a mission to find the renegade Colonel Kurtz. The movie Apocalypse Now broke the hearts and souls of grown men who were in it. You were 15 when you were cast in that film. You were like the kid in the boat taking Martin Sheen down the river. Your mother came with you to the Philippines to shoot the movie, right? How did your father feel? I mean, I'm sure you were expecting to be there for a few months. The movie took, I think, more than 2 years to
make. We were told we were going to be there for 3 months, and we wound up staying the better part of 2 years, 76 and 77.
So the family was divided for that period of time.
Well, you know, the family unit was my mother and myself. My mother and my father were, you know, divorced when I was very young.
Oh.
So I pretty much grew up with my mother. My father did, though, come over and spend a great deal of time with me. And it was actually for the first time in my life that my father and I lived together was when I was over there. And that was really nice. It was very, very, very nice. We were actually kind of together rather than that we were divided toward the end of the shooting. I think the last 6 months of the shooting, my father was there with my mother and I and my mother's new husband because she had remarried. So
I'm sure there were a lot of, I imagine that there were a lot of drugs on the set, a lot of marijuana and maybe LSD. So when your father was down there, him being a, you know, corrections officer, law enforcement guy, did he turn his head the other way?
Well, no, he didn't. He didn't, not at all. In fact, that was the reason that he came down.
Oh.
Because
to keep you straight?
Yeah, really, to keep me straight. Because my mother, like I said, she let me go and she couldn't get me back. So she called in the big guns.
So what did he do?
He followed me around everywhere I went, and he carried a big stick. You think I'm kidding?
He really did carry a stick?
He really did.
Did he use it on you?
No. My father's psychological. Psychological. My father's a very big man. He's very big.
Well, did he use that kind of psychological stuff on Dennis Hopper?
No, he didn't have to. He wasn't there for Dennis Hopper. He was there for me. So it worked.
It did?
It worked.
Yeah. Were you afraid?
Oh, yeah.
What was it like to be 15 years old and working with actors like Marlon Brando and Dennis Hopper, who seemed to have kind of flipped, you know? I saw the movie Hearts of Darkness about the making of Apocalypse Now, and as extraordinary Brando and Hopper are as actors, they seemed like they were so difficult to work with. And so here you were watching these, like, two great actors behaving bizarrely.
It was very interesting. Fortunately for me, my character is dead by the time we get to see those two guys. So I didn't have to work with them in that way. But as far as behavior, I had never seen anybody behave the way Dennis Hopper did. And I think we all know that no one behaves the way that Brando does other than Brando. So it was very interesting, and it was... I mean, I was very impressionable, 14, 15. I had never heard of Dennis Hopper. But when I saw him, I had never seen a human being behave that way. And I was like, this is the guy. This is the cat. Forget about Brando. Forget about Sheen. This is the man. I want to be like this man. Because he was just out, you know? He was in a continual state of chaos. He was just amazing to watch, and those were not his best days.
Right.
But in order for him to get where he is, he had to go through that. So, you know, I was very impressed. The whole experience, because I was so young, you see, to me, all of that was normal. It was only my second film. So I came back from that experience thinking, okay, well, this is the way you make movies. You have too much money, you have too much time, and you go completely crazy while you do it.
Larry Fishburne recorded in 1991. Coming up, Robert Duvall talks about his role in Apocalypse Now. This is Fresh Air. We're listening back to interviews about the making of Apocalypse Now, which is returning to theaters in a new recut expanded version. Robert Duvall plays the macho, war-loving Colonel Kilgore. Duvall also worked with director Francis Ford Coppola on the Godfather series, in which Duvall played Tom Hagen, the Corleone family lawyer. I spoke with Duvall in 1996. Now, you worked with Francis Ford Coppola on Apocalypse Now.
Right, right.
And in Apocalypse Now, you were Colonel Kilgore,
right.
Famous for the line...
But I love the smell of napalm in the morning. Is that the one?
That's
smells
the one.
Like victory, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a wonderful line. People come up to me and quote it to me as and say it like it's such an in thing between just me and them. And like it's like they're the only ones that ever thought of it. But that happens with everybody the same way.
Did you get the script and say, well, first of all, was that line in the script? Or is that something that you
Yeah,
otherwise?
No, that was in there. And I think the part was offered to somebody else and they turned it down. And I said to Francis, I know that the part's written for a bigger guy, real tall, big guy, rugged. But, you know, I'll just say once, I think maybe I could do the part and I'll put in my plea. And he gave it to me. So it was enjoyable. It was a lovely part and I enjoyed playing it very much.
You smell that? Napalm, son. Nothing else in the world smells like that. I love the smell of napalm in the morning. You know, one time we had a hail bomb for 12 hours when it was all over, I walked up. We didn't find one of them, not one stinking dink body. The smell, you know, that gasoline smell, the whole hill. Smelled like victory.
So when you saw the line in the film, I love the smell of napalm in the morning, did you say to yourself, a classic line, people will be repeating this back to me?
No, I didn't. I didn't think of that. I didn't think of it that way. I wasn't sure, you know. I mean, sometimes you're not so aware of that. Although you like lines like that.
Did you do a lot of different line readings on that? I love the smell of napalm.
I love the smell of napalm
in the morning.
The one that was most predominant, there was Jimmy Keane, a friend of mine who played a small part in that from Buffalo. I made him call me Mr. Duvall for a year because that was a relationship in the movie because, you know, but we're all on a first-name basis. But he's saying, now, how do you do this? And he was watching me, and he did great imitation. We were always doing imitation. So the final dress rehearsal before we filmed, we were always doing Brando imitation. So I said, I love the smell of napalm in the morning. I paused and I said, smells like victory. I did my Brando, and he couldn't believe I would do that, you know. So then he began doing Brando imitations. So then when Brando wanted $100,000 to do six lines of the censored stuff for the censored version of the TV version of The Godfather, and they wouldn't pay him, they got Jimmy Keane from Buffalo for $200 to do Brando.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So those imitations started in the Philippines, and Jimmy got, because of those imitations, blossomed into the guy that would do the censored version for Brando.
Hey, they could have saved a lot of trouble with Brando and Apocalypse Now, I guess.
I suppose, yeah. Well, Jimmy was the guy that was there that told me all these wild stories after I left. See, I did the second half of my part first, and then 6 months later came back into the first half. It was strange the way I had to go do another job because they got so bogged down with weather and with different actors and approaches and so forth. It took a long time to complete that film.
It must have been really different working with Coppola on the Godfather movies and working with him on Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, well, you see, I had worked with Francis in The Rain People, as I had said. And,
that was in the late 60s.
Kind of a moody guy, and I didn't quite get a handle on Francis. But then I gained a tremendous amount of respect for him because on Godfather 1, we started out, I said, okay, it's Francis again. He's not saying much. A little moody, you know, the way he is. He's a real, he never comes, I want to write a book someday called The Rushes Are Great because everybody protects everybody by saying The Rushes Are Great. Francis is one of the only guys that comes out of the cutting room with a long face, and maybe that's why he's so good in that he isn't always thrilled, you know. But I gained a lot of respect for him because in Godfather 1, physically, they had an understudy director following him around in case he failed to fire him and take over. And he worked under that pressure. I don't know how you would do that with a guy physically, like, over your shoulder in case we... And I think the first AD was the best friend of that would-be hopeful director. That's quite a lousy thing to do to a director, and I gained a lot of respect for Francis for working under that pressure.
When you were young, Brando was one of your heroes, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he was quite a phenom. I mean, there were others too, but he. And then you grow away from somebody's influence and find your own way.
So, what was it like to work with him when he was much older? He'd physically changed. It wasn't, I think, a particularly good period for him.
Well, no, in The Godfather, he was very trim. Yeah,
right. But
when I first worked with him, Apocalypse. Yeah, I wasn't really there when he worked.
Right.
I worked with him first in The Chase way back, and the first day he called me into his dressing room and we talked about the part. I said, to my wife, this is going to be great. We're going to be like brother. We had a great rapport. Then he never spoke to me again for 8 weeks. I wasn't quite used to that lifestyle of somebody not speaking to you at the beginning of a day, but that's the way he is, I guess. But I was respectful and admired him and enjoyed working with him. And as I say in Apocalypse Now, that he came into the jungle with his baby blue Mercedes driving down the jungle, after I had left. And then when I came back, he'd finished,
Robert Duvall, recorded in 1996. Apocalypse Now Redux opened today in New York and Los Angeles and opens in 30 more cities over the next couple of weeks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Delta Trade Paperback, a division of Random House, publisher of Driving Mr. Albert, A Trip Across America with Einstein's Brain, a work of nonfiction by Michael Paternity. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, the next Fresh Air, Francis Ford Coppola talks about the making of Apocalypse Now and its new re-edited version in a conversation with film critic Roger Ebert, recorded at this year's Cannes Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.